When you lose your mother, you lose your soul. When you lose your father, you lose your identity. But when you lose your son or daughter, you lose your heart. And I lost all three.
Welcome to the Still Parents Podcast. Click details in the description to find out more.
Welcome along to the Still Parents Podcast. I am Dan, joined as ever from the Lily May Foundation with Ryan Jackson and Matt Whitehouse. How are you, gents? You okay?
Fine, mate.
I'm going to introduce our guest today, the very special guest who's joining us in the studio despite living in that there Canada. His name's Azza. Is it Azza? Am I saying it correctly?
Yeah, it's Azza.
Azza Rabbani.
Yes.
So you're originally from the UK, but you moved to Canada. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Now, the reason why you're in the UK at the minute, just so that, because obviously as much as we'd like to say we've flew Azza over here, unfortunately it's not the case. No, just condolences, because you're here to bury your father.
Yes, my father passed away, sadly, and he was 91.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, what a man. He is a product of the Indian-Pakistan partition.
Okay.
Right, okay.
Just really quickly about him, I want to pay him a little tribute. So in 47... their house was ransacked and he jumped off the third floor with his mother and ran. And that jump represents my father's life.
Wow.
And as a dad, I mean, he played a very central part in the loss of my son. So,
and we will get into that. First, tell us about, because you do have your podcast too, and you have Still Dad, and Still Dad Talk is the podcast. Could you explain what both of those are?
Yeah, so Still Dad was really created out of a need for dads, basically. Mm. So, you know, if I look at, I'm 21 years in.
So you lost Hashim in 2005.
April, 27th of April, 2005. So, you know, I couldn't find anything.
Yeah.
At that time, I mean, you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. And the question is, you know, if I look back, it's frustrating because there's a lot of things that you forget. And that was one of my fears, losing the memory of my son.
These guys are nodding.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really scary. And so the question, what did I want? 21 years ago, I just simply wanted to talk to another father who'd been through the same thing.
Yep.
It was as simple as that.
Yeah.
I couldn't find one. Maybe I didn't look hard enough. I don't know.
There would have been a lot less ways to, the social media would have been in its absolute infancy.
Yeah, that's
2005 was like just Tom on MySpace.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's true. It's true.
Yeah. And so I remember making a promise to him that I'd do something worthwhile in my life. And I ran a very, very high stressful, busy food business. We were supplying people like Wagamamas and Carluccio's and Las Iguanas. And
oh, really?
All the top high street brands we were supplying.
Oh, right.
And so I was in the food game for 30 years. So life took over in terms of business, in terms of, and the griever supporter quandary every day. Mm. What am I? Am I a griever? Am I a supporter? And I chose, sitting in the car park at the hospital before going in to see my son, that I am going to be a supporter, that my grief does not matter. And those are choices that we make because it's what we've been indoctrinated into.
Mm.
It's what we've been taught. You know, be stoic, be strong, be
yep,
all that stuff. So, and the business was a great place to hide.
Yeah,
there we go.
Because you were busy.
Yeah, busy.
Constantly.
That was your distraction as we referred to it.
Distraction.
Yeah,
distraction.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, there were other issues in terms of relationships, in terms of, you know, relationship drift and grieving styles, you know, with my wife at the time. And so...
So you guys are no longer together?
No, we're not together. Yeah. And you know, she was by nature sort of a closed off person. She was very private. I love to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, I wanted to tell the world, as you do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I had three living kids at the time also.
Yeah.
Three boys. And so you think about the support needed just to speak to, telling your children, they're waiting for a new baby to arrive and you got to break the news to them.
How old were your three living children at the time when you had your loss in 2005?
So Haider was 11, Hamza was 9, and Hassan was 7.
Slight tangent. How old are you then? Because if you had kids who were born in the 90s.
Yeah, I'm 60.
No, you're not.
Yeah, I am.
60?
Yeah, that's what I'm like. You don't know.
Look at all that. Look at that. All that hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, and my oldest is going to be 32 in March of next year.
So they were all,
wow,
at an age to have some kind of understanding, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's the key here. We have, because we've had a lot of parents on, haven't we, that they have children who are in play. Well, I mean, Ryan, yeah. Alfie was 3, wasn't he, when you know, and so you had children who were...
I would like to get into that because I know there's a conversation to be had. But before we do, could you, if you don't mind, as we do with all of our guests, could you please tell us the story about your loss of Hashim, please?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we had 3 pregnancies, no problems before that. And
all straightforward, everything. Also,
no issues. I mean, okay. Heather, my first was early, but then he's impatient about everything anyway. So. And, you know, he came into this world screaming and said, "Put me back in." But there you go. You know.
Wasn't that "put me back in"? I'm sure that was an actual line from "Look Who's Talking."
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
it was.
Yeah. It was actually
Bruce Willis.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And so Hashim was full term, okay, and he was actually overdue. And my I think 2-3 days before. Or day before he was due, she says something's not right. She couldn't feel him.
Mm.
And I said, "It'll be fine, don't worry." And she said, "Okay, well, you know, I'm going to see the GP." Mm. It's the only time I've regretted that actually I wasn't with her, because I had a meeting at work and I said, "Look, let me know how it goes." And I'd been to all the appointments before then. I get a call, I don't know, maybe 1 o'clock on the 26th. And I can hear her, and she's running to the car and said, "They can't find the heartbeat." I don't actually remember getting off my desk and getting in the car.
It's scary, isn't it, when you think about it?
I do not remember. By the way, the car was my safe space. That was where I really let go. Nobody could see me, right? And I remember having this conversation in the car with the big guy upstairs, saying, "If I've done, you know, bartering, I'm bartering with him, saying, you know, I'm sorry for this. I'm sorry for this. Don't let this happen. You know, I'll do this. I'll do this. I'll do this." And I'm negotiating. Can you imagine? I'm negotiating my way to the hospital. I also called my father up, and I told him. I didn't ask him to come to the hospital. I told him, "Look, this is what's happened. Potentially, you know, stay tuned." And I got to the hospital, and, you know, as we, I think I mentioned it earlier, that I sat in the car park for about 5 minutes, and I made a decision that I'm going to be the supporter, that my kids need me, my wife needs me, my community, I ran a 250 employees, big business, right? I didn't matter.
So the decision was to be the supporter and not
the griever.
So how did you come to that decision?
It's what I saw in my life. Mm. My father. So I've seen the men in my upbringing as completely, you know, zip it, suppress your feelings.
Is that a generational thing or a cultural thing or a mixture of the two?
I think mixture of two. I think you see it in the West. You see it in the West. You know. Especially a leader, whether you're at home, whether you're in business, you don't express your opinion. You lead,
yeah,
right? And what I've learned is actually vulnerability is very powerful.
Mm.
It's where a lot of things sit. You know, leadership sits around vulnerability. Authenticity sits around vulnerability. So that was really, and so I sat in the car. I made that decision, and I sat in that decision for 20 years, and it didn't serve me. It just did not serve me. I was constantly getting triggered. I was constantly unhappy. I was angry all the time. And I'll come back to this because there's a real underlying current here, because what spills into other areas of life was based around that one decision. That one decision.
Wow. So it's like a sliding doors moment then.
Absolutely. So I remember actually, you know, falling out of the car because my legs had given way. And then suddenly I got the energy and I ran. And when I got, I got into the hospital room, I can see my wife. She's sitting there in the corner opposite the door, and there's a window there, and the sunlight was coming through, and she was shit scared. I mean, and I didn't know what to say to her. Anyway, they wheeled in the scan and the trolley on a trolley, and within 5 minutes, I mean, it's confirmed. Now, the issue was, so my father walked in, and you know what? My I laugh because my father's not the most empathetic guy in the world. You know, he, at the best of times, he...
Right.
You know, and, but my God, did he show up.
Wow, okay.
Nice.
And sometimes, you know, when you're in that position, you guys will know, sometimes... you wish somebody didn't say anything, right? Just hold that space. And my father held that space for me. He showed up and he did exactly the thing that I wanted him to do. We cried together, which felt like...
Had you ever seen him cry before?
Not the way that he did there, you know. If something, I don't know. It's an amazing experience. And he put his hand on my shoulder and we cried. No words. And he said, I am going to be sitting outside if you need me. And I don't know when he left. I don't know how long he sat there. Just to keep on my father's story. A few weeks later, there's a friend of mine that came to the business and we're sitting in the boardroom and my father walked in. And this, what he says next is, I mean, it's a measure of the man, and it's also tells me how he was suffering. He said to him, to my friend, he said, how do you console a son who's lost a son? And it made me realize that he was struggling in the same way as I was struggling trying to explain the situation to my kids. And we were really paired in that struggle. Just didn't know. He was so lost for words. Generally, he talks a lot. He was never lost for words. But he just did not know how to support me. He was, you know. And so...
shows you how big the moment is.
It's a huge moment. Because there's 2-3 things that he's done in my life. And in terms of supporting me. That I will never forget. I'll take with me in my grave. That's the man that he was. Let's go back to the story. So how does that baby come out?
Mm.
The problem was that she was 2-3 days in. The water in the placenta had become poisonous, basically. So they couldn't do a C-section and had to be normally delivered. And she had to be induced. So they waited till I think at the end of the day. So he was born asleep in the early hours of 27th of April. Now, 27th of April is also my nephew's birthday. And he is my sister's son, and I'm living with them at the moment. I come here, I live there.
Yeah.
So he is a reminder constantly to me. And I get another reminder. My younger brother, his wife was pregnant with their first. Mehdi was 4 months behind. So every time I see Mehdi, it reminds me of what I've lost. So it's these constant reminders, even now, you know. Anyway, she was induced. He came out. And I mean, the silence. The silence is deafening.
How many times have I said that? You've said, I can't empathize with this bit, but you can. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, and you know what was, I think, I mean, it makes me angry even now I think about it, was that they did not segregate us from the other births that were going on.
We hear this a lot again.
Yeah.
And that's because of that, the silence became even louder.
Yeah. Were you close on that?
No, we were on the labour ward.
You're on the labour ward, yeah.
Because it was such a small hospital. So, she was giving birth on the labour ward. And they tried to, they tried to put us in a room which was as far away as possible from any other live birth. But I've used that terminology on a number of occasions, how it is the most deafening silence. And I'm going to go off on a slight tangent. I went to Auschwitz and Birkenau for my 40th birthday. And when we got off the bus at Birkenau and walked into where the concentration camp is, I always said at that point, that is the most deafening silence I've ever heard in my life. And it was freaky, deafening silence. It's like somebody was scrambling the airwaves and you couldn't think, you couldn't do anything because it was so loud, yet so quiet at the same time. It gives me shivers because you thinking think about it.
You're not there, but you are there, right? Yeah. Like you're almost like, you can imagine, I suppose.
Bit of a strange birthday present, though.
Well, we went to Krakow. Amy had arranged for me. I wanted to go away for my 40th, and because we'd just come out of COVID as well.
So she sent you to a concentration camp.
We went to Poland, and she'd always known that I'd always wanted to go there. Yeah. And she did actually apologise because she said out the 3 days that we were there, the only time that she could book was actually on my 40th birthday.
Yeah.
But it didn't bother
me.
You
sent me a message that day going, I thought I was going to Hooters.
I'll tell you what, I was in New York just 4 years after 9/11, went to Ground Zero, and it was like, you're in New York, bustling, loud. You literally turn a corner, and it was almost like a respect thing. Everyone was almost like, "We can't. Yeah. We're not going to talk here."
Yeah.
So, but
that silence. It's just that you've talked about there.
Tangible, isn't it?
It's tangible. It's not even subconscious. Actually, thinking about it, because when somebody gives birth, you instantly expect to cry.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, your mind tricks you, doesn't it? Because you're expecting a cry and you're thinking, they must have got it wrong, because you're looking at your son or your daughter and you're thinking, there's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah.
And congenitally, they're perfect.
Absolutely. And, we knew that there was no heartbeat, but we were hoping.
Mm. Of course you do.
Or suddenly he'll wake up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And essentially what had happened to him was that the placenta, there was a blood clot.
Yeah.
And he suffocated.
Yeah.
He just suffocated. And you know, he was alive like 3-4 days prior. Right. He was kicking.
Mm.
So it happened in the sort of last 3 days. And he was overdue anyway. Mm. And that's why we're wondering, okay, you know, what happened? Anyway, so, and you know, here's the thing. The loss is the loss. And the trauma is the trauma. And the grief, you know, the grief actually started for me when I received the phone call.
Mm.
A lot of people say, if I look at my dad, for example, and I've experienced the loss of my mother. By the way, I actually want to say something here with those three losses. When you lose your mother, you lose your soul. When you lose your father, you lose your identity. But when you lose your son or daughter, you lose your heart.
Wow.
And I lost all three.
I also just want to touch upon, just go back a little bit in the conversation about what you said about your father. My dad is, there's no DNA test needed with us. We look like twins when we stood next to each other. He's still alive at the moment and he turns 80 in a couple of weeks. What you said about him not saying anything, when my dad came into the room when we were with Callie, I knew how big it was because these two have met my dad.
He's brilliant.
But he just talks. He just stood and he shook his head and he didn't know what to say. And I thought, and he didn't really talk to me for like almost 2 days. They came back and forth, but he didn't really. And that was the point. And I've said this many times. I realized how big this moment was when he can't find words, because he can find words about anything. You know, when I'm on the phone to him, like he says when I'm trying to get off the phone, which I'm very grateful for still having that conversation. I'm not keeping you, am I? But I've got to get moving, Dad. But then I just keep talking. But he just went. He's silenced. But the silence, I think you're right, was what I needed as well. And so yeah, I do resonate with that moment. There's no question about it. Yeah.
This is quite. I'm in a completely different place because this is quite difficult for me to talk about my dad because I don't have a relationship with my dad currently. But my dad was the same when we lost Lily in the respect that he didn't say anything. I vaguely remember, very, very vaguely remember walking out of the delivery suite door and my legs literally just gave way. Like, it's the only time I think I've ever been out of control.
You almost like fell over.
Yeah, my legs just gave way and I just down to my knees. And I remember him picking me up and I remember him just massaging my shoulders. But he didn't say anything. If he did, I certainly don't bloody remember it. But you've got an Instagram page at stilldad_, and you've got some really thought-provoking comments on that page. And there's one that stood out for me. In fact, two that have stood out for me. There's one that says, there is no hierarchy to grief. A shorter story doesn't mean a smaller love.
Yeah.
That's a very thought-provoking post. But then there's another one as well, which is, write grief down, let it land and sit.
Yeah. And I want to speak about that one.
Yeah.
That's really, really important.
It's an interesting one.
Let's do it right now.
Yeah. So if I fast forward to kind of what I'm doing right now, I knew I had to build something for supporting fathers. So I've always liked writing. Writing is a really important, and we've lost something.
Like journaling or like fiction or?
All of it.
Okay.
For the moment, all of it. The schooling system and generations have lost the ability to understand what writing actually does for you as you're growing up, as your brain develops.
Yes.
Right? We've lost it.
Yeah.
And so my 5-week program, which is going to be part of something a lot bigger, is a writing experience. And it's very structured. It's a framework. And having spoken to certain fathers, a lot of fathers, in fact, the feedback has been that they understand journaling. They're doing therapy, by the way, but there's something missing. And this goes, I'm just going to touch on this. So I've developed a concept called the grief stool. So there's 3 legs to that grief stool. And the 2 of them, dads know about. The third one is why the stool keeps falling. So the first one is you lose a child, you're in grief, you want to know about it. So you read. You grab a book, you read. The second leg is a standard reaction, go get therapy. You know, and I have my dads who are 2 years into therapy and they're still feeling hollow. They're still feeling stuck. You know, they're still falling over. The third leg is what is missing. The third leg is non-clinical support. And when I say non-clinical support, there's 2 parts to it. There's a structured framework that supports the father and the experience. And it needs a community of dads who've been through the same thing. You put those 3 together, all of a sudden the therapy makes sense, the books make sense, and the loss starts to make sense. I was talking to a dad who is a vice president of a company in the United States, and he said something really profound that I'm actually using a lot of that in the outcome that dads desire, right? And he said, get me to a place where I could think, I could breathe, and I can find some relief. They don't want fixing. They just, you know, and you guys know this, right? It's this complete numbness, this complete, you know, resignation that nobody, and I've got dads coming into the program completely resigned to the fact that nobody can help them. Now, let's go back to the writing. The writing, so it's 5 90-minute sessions across 5 weeks. And it's a structured framework where there is a presentation that I give. So we do a check-in with each of the fathers, and it's maximum of seven dads. You know, each one has a title. So the first session is naming the loss. You write about naming loss. There's six prompts, and they start writing about what happened because they have never done it. And here's the thing about writing. There's 40 years of research that's backed this up, writing and trauma and grief. And writing helps to rewire the brain. And what it does is the trauma sits in the center part of the brain, which is the fear and flight area, and just constantly reoccurs, just repeats itself because it's got nowhere to land, especially for guys. Women are different because they've got all the support network and everything, and rightfully so, absolutely right. But we suffer because we don't know where to put it safely. And what do we want? Dads want a private space. They don't want to perform. They don't want to talk about it openly, right?
Yeah, just internalized.
Yeah, it's, yeah. And so what writing does is that it takes it from, and it has to be handwritten, not typed. So it's moves from here, through the arm, through the fingers, pen onto paper. And what was staring you internally, which you didn't know what to do with, all of a sudden now sits on a piece of paper externally looking at you.
Yeah.
And you then can take what's there. You can do whatever you want with it. You can share it. You can actually fold it away, put it away next to the picture of your child and come back to it later. And that process rewires the brain. It allows you. I have experienced this, and I've got fathers who've gone through the program, have experienced this. They sleep better, reduces cortisol levels, reduces stress. They're going to doctors less. And so this 5-week program, and it's in conjunction with a dad's club, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, Sad Dad's Club,
yeah,
right?
Sad Dad's Club, right. And so what has happened is that I had a dad who came in. By the way, this is any child loss. Yeah. So it's not just babies. So I had a dad who came in who lost his 23-year-old in the last cohort. He was run down by an SUV. And having that mix of fathers with those is really important because all of a sudden, you know, and I'm not, there's no hierarchy in grief. Yeah. My grief is no less than Matt, yours, or you know, Ryan, yours. Or
that's another one of your one of your quotes. It talks about the hierarchy of grief. It says there is no hierarchy to grief. A shorter story doesn't mean a smaller love.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Writing is a very cathartic experience, isn't it? It's
unless you're Matt, because he's handwriting shit.
Well, this is what I was...
Right. I mean, he's not wrong. I could actually write better with my ball bag. Matt wouldn't disagree with me.
Oh, why is that image in my head now?
I mean, that is horrendous. But
writing... Yeah. The reason why I mention this is because I have a habit of, if I'm feeling a bit worked up or my brain's a bit fuzzy or there's something weighing on it, I'll just write loads of, I really never lose my phone just for fear, not photos, for fear what people are going to see in my notes section.
Yeah.
Because I have a habit of writing how I'm feeling and I'll literally never read it or never show it to anyone.
Yeah.
But afterwards, it's like doing a word poo, isn't it? It's like, the only way I can really put it.
It is like word vomit.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
And then sometimes I'll read it back and go, right, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Or go, I made a point. But I'm exaggerating a point to make a point. It's just find the whole process cathartic.
Yes.
So yeah.
Yeah, it is very much that. And look, when I say write a letter, I don't mean of write a whole letter.
Matt writes the letter R. That's the whole finished.
Ma for Matt.
It could be one word. It could be one letter, by the way.
Ignore both of them. Ignore
Sorry,
both of them.
So the number four is what next?
Yeah.
What comes next? Now, we're not talking about some big grand plan.
Yeah.
It's just one small thing. You know, having breakfast without crying.
Because that's an interesting... I'll be honest with you, that's an interesting one. And I don't know if Ryan can resonate with this with the people he's worked with in the past. But obviously, me and Ryan work with a lot of dads who come into this our program of support. I find with the dads, a lot of the dads that I work with, is that their direction is lost moving forwards. It comes back to the what you've always said, right? A lot of men are the fixers, aren't they? And because they can't fix this, they get lost with where they want to go next and what it looks like. And you have to settle them back in and go, you'll figure it out. You will.
Yeah.
You'll find your way. Yeah. But men are, a lot of the time, they have to know what's next.
Yeah. They want a framework.
Right. They want a structure. They want to know what's next. They want to go, right, this has happened. It's like what you did with yourself. I'm going to be the supporter. Yeah. Because you knew that was the way you needed to do it.
Yeah.
And interesting.
It's really,
direction, is it structure, framework, routine?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what? The it's really interesting. They have lost the ability to give themselves permission.
Mm. Absolutely.
Allowing yourself to be vulnerable and allowing yourself to hurt, it's almost like it's not the norm, because if you hurt yourself, let's say physically you hurt yourself, you cut yourself, it hurts, you clean it up, you put a plaster on it, it gets better. The difference with this type of hurt is that you're hurting, but you don't understand this type of hurt, because it's, whilst you do have a bit of physical pain, it's emotional pain, which is not something which is so understandable in the moment. You can never be 24/7 wholly consumed by gripping grief that effectively stops you from doing anything.
You have said this.
It is impossible. It's not possible. Yeah. Yes, you're in grief and you're in that journey, but it comes in waves. It's like a sound wave. It comes in waves, doesn't it?
They're waves. And initially the waves are a lot fierce and ferocious.
And a lot closer together.
And you feel you're gonna drown.
Yeah.
But also if you're consumed in grief forever, you don't go on to do things what you're doing, what we're doing here, because it's impossible. And I've said it so many times, I'm sure that you guys feel the same, but I am now at this point where I'm so grateful for Callie coming along because of what she's given me. It's a simple, that's how I see it. Listen, are there tough times? Absolutely. Of course there are.
Do you know, for such a long time, I sat in that loss. I'm talking about two decades. And it's very recently I realized that my boy is a gift.
Absolutely.
He's a gift. He's a gift to me. And he's sitting somewhere up there talking to his mates and saying, that's my dad. That's my old man. He's fulfilling a promise to me.
Absolutely.
And I want to look at it that way. I don't care about anyone. And this is another thing. I've stopped caring about what other people think. I don't give a shit, my friend.
I am with you there.
I'm getting more like that. I'm not as much as
my Ryan signature strip. My signature strip on my email says Azrabani, Hashim's dad.
Love that.
I don't care. Somebody doesn't like it. You know, nobody has objected to it.
Mm.
And this is my mind playing games with me. Mm. And so we sit in the space of conformity. Right, fathers feel they don't bring up their child because they're managing the expectations of others, not wanting to make it awkward for somebody else. And I sat in that space for years.
Mm.
You know, I wouldn't talk about him. And by the way, people still get awkward even now. I don't care. You're awkward. That's your problem.
Yeah,
it's true though.
Exactly that. Exactly that. That's the way I look at things. Is like, if you're awkward with me talking about Lily, or you're awkward with me in whatever, well, that's a you problem.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
It's not a me problem. Yeah. That's a you problem.
Yeah.
Because I have to live this daily.
Yeah.
You're having a bit of an uncomfortable few seconds.
Yeah.
Oh, poor you.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Quite liberating, really.
It is. And it's refreshing. Right. You feel free.
Yeah.
You know, when I put that signature strip on, for a split second, you think, should I send it? And I thought, fuck it. I'll just do it.
Go with it.
Yeah, just do it. Right. Anyway, going back to the program. So number five, week five, is a letter to my child.
You've done that, haven't you?
Yeah, so the end of Callie's book is a letter.
Yeah.
I've done the letter to her.
And the letter to my child is, so this is a journey that I took, and it's amazing, guys. Actually, I've got the picture. I put I put those five, there were six at that time, five, six steps on a whiteboard. That's where it started, and it sat there for years. And my problem was that I didn't think anybody would be interested.
Mm.
Fear of being judged.
Yeah.
I was just about to say as well, it's probably fear of failure.
Yes, very much.
And
fear of success, by the way.
Yeah.
That too.
Yeah.
We don't talk enough about fear of success. You know, failure, absolutely.
Yeah.
You are right.
Yeah.
And I think the interesting part is, I mean, I've been an entrepreneur all my life. So after Hashim, we had a cyber attack on our business in 2018. And we lost it was a £45 million business, $60 million business. And it was on the bank holiday, August bank holiday. I remember the day. 2018, I had 1,000 orders to go out to restaurants on the Saturday. And somebody had opened up a email on the Friday and they encrypted everything.
Oh.
Everything. And I watched that business slip away over 6 months.
Oh my God.
That's horrible. That's grief also, by the way.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then based on that, marriage went to pot. My mother passed away a few years later. Lost the house. Lost the cars. Lost my relationship with my now adult kids. So everything that I identified with as a man, as a husband, as a father, son, was slowly being taken away. And now it's the perfect storm. So the doors finally shut in March of 19. Then COVID happened. And I've actually sat down and thought about all those losses. What's the common denominator that sits in those losses? What was the thing why was I unhappy when I had all those things? And that was it. That was the issue. I was really unhappy. I was trying to find an answer. And there's one common denominator, and that was this. For anybody who's listening, I just really want you to think about this. I didn't get support. I did not look after my backyard, my emotional needs when Hashim passed. And everything else basically spilt. That lack of support, that understanding of where I as a man was, spilt into every facet of my life, in my relationships, in my business, how I was showing up, how I was presenting. You know, I found a winning formula because the business went down, I think, 12 years after Hashim. But everything was strained, triggered, angry. It's a learning. You have to relearn your emotion. You have to relearn how to carry grief. It really pisses me off when somebody says, oh, over time, you know what? You'll move on. Well, fuck that.
That's just platitudes, isn't it?
I'm not going to move on. Yeah. I don't want to move on.
Yeah.
I don't want to lose the memory of my son. I don't want to lose the pain. Sounds strange. I want to sit in that pain.
It does. It becomes a comfort blanket.
It does. It does. Yeah. You want that because that's the only connection you've got left.
Yeah.
So for me, it's moving with grief. What does that mean? That means you carry yourself, you carry your child, you carry your partner, your family, you carry the memories, you carry everything, and it allows you to move forward in life and live a full life.
Part of you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely part of you. It's who I am today. And if like in anything, if you unnaturally smother things, it's gonna resurface.
Mm.
In a pretty ugly way.
Yeah.
How can people get involved and where can they find details about it?
Yeah, so on the website, there's a contact page. They can contact me off the website.
The website is, the link's in the description, but...
Yeah, it's stilldad.net.
Yeah.
There is, so the framework, and this is really important,
People do it, sorry, before I forget, can people do it anywhere across over the globe?
Yes, it's global. So the whole idea is that I want to build this community where the 5 weeks is a gateway. So they come in into the community. I've built 4 advanced workshops around returning back to work. There's dealing with guilt, letter to the living, and the man who I am now. And there's an arc that this follows. It's suggested. The 2 things that dads need to do, they come in the 5 weeks. So I call it the gateway, the letter writing journey gateway. I want to give them permission to give themselves how they want to go. Mm. So I really want them to understand that you are in charge of this. You decide. Mm. But here's a recommendation if you want to follow. At the end, and this is the important part, at the end, the same cohort that came through in the beginning will meet at the end, do the 5-week journey again, and they get to...
Interesting. See where they are then?
They get to see how much movement they've had emotionally.
That's a great idea.
That's interesting, isn't it?
There's a lot of chatter on the internet about dads now. There's, you know, podcasters like yourself who are doing excellent work to put stuff out there. But if I look at support,
yeah,
and I'm talking about non-clinical support, there's nothing out there. Mm. I am not a clinician.
Yeah.
I make it very clear. It's a disclaimer. I'm not a therapist. You know, I'm a grief guide. Yeah. And what does that mean? I hold the space.
Yeah.
The work that's done in the workshops is work they do based around certain questions and experiences.
But it's that connection with you because you've been there and it's happened to you, and it's, you know, 2 decades of living with that grief.
And at the same time, though, I've seen registered counsellors, registered clinicians, if they haven't lived the experience that you've been through, you can read me anything from a book that you've learned over your degree course or that you've learned. I ain't going to listen to you because you have no lived real experience. Yeah. You'd never send an electrician to do a plumber's job. Yeah. It's. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So it's, yeah.
Matt would.
Absolutely. If I can, I have these 7 fathers and I'm framing a particular a week and I'm looking at them and they're nodding their heads. Huh. They're acknowledging through the body language. They're saying, yeah, we get you. And it's fascinating to watch and I've mentioned this, the permission levels change when it's led by somebody who's gone through the process because there's trust there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm not going to sit here on this podcast and tell you guys how you should feel because it's not my place. Yeah. It's just here to empathize and to learn things myself about how you're feeling.
But the problem is, though, sadly, there are people out there who do try to tell you how you should feel.
Yeah.
Because it's... This is the linear model that's reported on how you grieve, and which is complete nonsense in itself.
It's never a straight line.
No.
But it's all over the place.
But also, I what you said about investing in kind of the work that you do, I say to my clients a lot of the time that we can do the sessions, but you've got to go away and try things yourself.
Yeah.
You've got to go away and do bits away from here because the people who move the smoothest through the process are the ones who are willing to open their mind up and just have a go at it. It's not always going to work. Yeah. It really isn't.
It's not for everybody. For example, the writing's not for everybody.
But if you go away from here and you try something and inevitably, in general, they come back and they're like, I tried that even for half an hour this week and it's made me feel loads better. Mm. It will get it will move you through things a little bit.
Dads get homework and it could be simple as, you know, add something of value to what you've written.
Yeah,
add
do you mark it with like red pen, like bring back the scoreboard,
F and an A plus. Yeah,
this one came off AI.
Before we say goodbye, is there anything that you would like that we haven't asked you, or anything you'd like to touch on?
I think, honestly, one of the things I would say is to any father who's going, especially in the early days on the journey, firstly, sorry for your loss. And secondly, don't wait. Just don't wait for something to happen. Take the first step. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't, you know. And yes, read. Yes, take therapy. Yes, find non-clinical support. But the option of not doing anything is not an option.
Right, these guys are nodding their heads.
Yeah.
It's absolutely not.
Because you did wait for a while. I'm sorry to bring you in.
Yeah. 6 years, but yeah.
Azhar Rubani on the Still Parents podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. And you're always welcome to come back on again. I'm sure we will get you back on at some
point. Absolutely, yeah.
And I just want to say to the three of you, thank you so much for making time. And I've come into the UK in a very short space of time. So this was a beautiful fit that you guys have done for me. And I'm grateful. I'm so grateful.
Thank you.
No, it's no worries.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in.
Take care, everyone. We'll be back with our next episode of the Still Parents podcast very, very soon. See you later.
Bye-bye, guys.